Hi there, listeners. Welcome to episode 254 Side B of Never on the Back Foot podcast. In this episode, we delve deep into the India versus Australia series and reflect on all the insights and observations. Without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Mohan. Welcome back to side B of this episode. We now, you know, divert our attention to the Australia series. I think off record also, we've been talking about how, you know, this was such an interesting series, which also presented us with a lot of talking points. So to kickstart our discussion, let's look at the one-off test series, right? I think for all of us as fans, and I think I speak for you also when I say this now, imagine in a span of like 15 days, India was already playing another test match. So how excited were you at this proposition? And playing Australia at home is kind of the dream, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was quite excited for the test because like you said, like India don't really play all that often. And I think like before this, before the last home season, like they'd played, what, two tests in 9 years. So I think it was quite cool that they were playing two tests back to back in like 15 days. So yeah, and like you said, Australia are obviously the best team in the world in the two shorter formats. And the last time they played in India was a really long while back. I think almost 40 years ago, if I'm not wrong. So I think that is when they last played a test. So it was obviously a very big deal that India was hosting Australia for a home test.
Absolutely. And, you know, playing Australia at home in a test match after, you know, that span of 40 odd years was definitely going to be exciting. And the match kind of lived up, right, to its reputation because dismissing Australia for just, what, 219 in their first essay. Do you think it was like a brilliant first innings bowling by India?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you rightly said, it was a great bowling display. And it was actually that bowling display which was key to winning that match because Australia ended up scoring at least 150 runs less than what they would have wanted in that first innings. And that ultimately proved to be the difference in this match. So I think India bowled exceptionally well in that first innings because the pitch for this match was a lot better than the England match for batters. Like the ball wasn't turning all that much. Like even if it was turning, it was slow turn. So it wasn't that difficult to negotiate. So it was just some very good bowling from India. And again, just like the England test, it was Pooja Vastrakar who like did the bulk of the damage for India on the opening day in the first session. Getting Ellis Perry bowled for just four with a great delivery. And then she also like picked up a couple of other key wickets. She got Beth Mooney, who obviously is Australia's key batter in all formats. And she also got Annabel Sutherland, who scored 100 in the last test they'd played. So yeah, she got a few key wickets and they made a big difference for India.
Oh, yes, definitely. Because the kind of start that Australia had, a lot of us, you know, following up this course because we were in college, we were like, is India going to let go of this match and, you know, have Australia score a big total? But I think restricting them to 219 was so very commendable. And even when you look at India's first innings, now they made 406 to, you know, counteract this big score. And again, we had good knocks coming in from the openers. Then you had Jemmy and Richa chipping in. And eventually it was, you know, good innings coming from Pooja and Deepthi. So again, were you convinced with India's batting depth here? And this is definitely not an area of concern for us.
Yeah, like we were discussing for the England test as well, it was actually the batting depth which saved India because when Pooja Vastrakar walked out, there was 265 for 6. So like considering the kind of bowling attack Australia have and how well they bowl, like India could have easily been bowled out for 300, which would have been a lead of just 80 odd runs. But that partnership of 100 plus between Pooja and Deepthi was key because it helped India get to 400 and that like made a big difference. And both these players were excellent right through the home test season. Like I think India's all-round quality in the form of these two and Sneh Rana was what proved to be the difference, especially on the kind of pitches that they played on versus England and Australia in this home season. So for me, like these three were the biggest stars of the two tests India played in the home season.
Absolutely, hands down, they were, you know, a class apart that kind of really paved the way for India's wins, right? And even looking at Australia, like somewhere in their second innings as well, they seem to be in a good space, you know, before being bowled out for 261. So what do you think could have attributed to that collapse? Because at one stage, you're looking so good and suddenly, you know, you lose all your wickets. And did they like lose sight of the total they had in mind?
I think they would have wanted to like set a target of around 250 for India in the fourth innings. And I think they were like playing pretty well. I think at one point, Elisa Healy and Magra were having a really good partnership and pushing the total towards 300. But I think like Harmanpreet Kaur made a key difference in that second innings because her choosing to come on to bowl late on that day, on the third day, and then dismissing two well-set batters in Thalia Magra and Alisa Healy was a big turning point because, and they were like quality dismissals. She got Thalia Magra bowled, like the ball took the inside edge and went on to the stump. So she was a little unfortunate as well. And then she got Alisa Healy LBW. So I think those two wickets were really key for India because after that, none of the new batters managed to get set or get their eye in apart from Annabelle Sutherland. So getting those two, the Australian captain and vice captain in quick succession was a big turning point.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's where we need to give, you know, due credit to the Indian bowling for kind of just making the most of that surface and putting pressure, right, on the Aussie batters. Now, of course, you know, dismissing Australia with 261 came with the perks of having to just chase a total of 75. And India did this without much difficulty, you know, courtesy that brilliant knock coming from Smriti Mandhana and support from the other end coming in from Jemmy. So what did you make of that run chase? And somewhere did you have the nerves? Because we know, right, how sometimes a target that small can also get tricky to chase.
Yeah, I think, but like you said, the credit entirely has to go to the bowlers for what they did in the second innings. I think like all of India's spinners, especially Sneha Rana, was excellent. She got a 4-4 and she was like really leading the bowling attack, got key wickets as well, got Elise Perry, got Annabelle Sutherland, and bowled really well, like got the ball to really dip and turn and was very difficult to face. After that, like any team that's worth their salt should be able to get 75 in the fourth innings, especially on that pitch, which didn't really have too many demons in it. It had a little bit of assistance for bowlers, but yeah, like it was a fairly good pitch to bat on even in the fourth innings. And as somebody who's played so much of international cricket, like that is what is expected of somebody like Smriti. So she got the job done. So yeah, I don't think there should have been any nerves. At least they weren't there for me because it was such a small total. Had it been more than 180, then probably yeah. But considering how good India have been in test cricket and how well suited their batters are to this format, like I thought 75 should have been a walk in the park, which it turned out to be.
Definitely. And also, you know, I remember reading a lot of discourse and myself feeling this very strongly that perhaps, you know, the introduction of a World Test Championship for women's test cricket can actually help make it an exciting proposition and inclusive for all the teams, right? Because we have seen how the big three in cricket often, you know, end up playing tests and we don't have other countries being included. So do you also, you know, believe in the school of thought that perhaps the introduction of a World Test Championship will add more relevance to these test matches?
Not at all. If anything, like maybe they can look to play a test in every series, but that only would be the four teams who are interested in playing it, out of which South Africa aren't interested in hosting home tests. So like I think the World Test Championship concept is a complete non-starter because in the men's game itself, now more and more countries are just playing it for the sake of it. Like if you look at the upcoming South Africa-New Zealand test series, South Africa have sent a completely second-string test squad, the men's team. And that is because they are prioritizing the SA20, which is like a great product and which is being like really enjoyed by the fans and the people of the country and which has developed a lot of their players also who've gone to excel at the international level. So for me, It makes absolutely no sense to have a World Test Championship. What they should look at doing, though, is like having more ODI and T20I fixtures. Because if you look at the Indian women's team, they've played just six ODIs in the last 12 months, which is just not good enough with the next ODI World Cup 18 months away. So instead of wasting time, money, and resources on something like a World Test Championship, which like 90% of the countries aren't even interested in playing, it's best to like focus those energies on ODI and T20I cricket and trying to make the World Cups more inclusive by having more teams there instead of just 8 or 10 teams. So I personally don't think a World Test Championship makes any sense for the women's game.
Fair enough. And a sub question to follow up would be, now we have players, you know, from say New Zealand, Sri Lanka and Pakistan have kind of expressed their interest to play test matches. Do you still then see, you know, this whole financial viability and the cricket boards having a larger say than player interests here?
Ultimately, the player interest would be in the board paying them well and taking care of their needs. And the boards also have a monetary responsibility, and anybody wouldn't want to keep on putting a product that doesn't draw in the viewers, right? Or like, which is not financially viable or doesn't draw in the sponsors. And like, these boards aren't even all that interested in playing men's test cricket, because for them, it just doesn't bring in the revenue. So they'd much rather spend it on tournaments where they get those revenues, which they can then use in funding grassroots cricket or playing or paying the players better. So I understand the need for the players, that some players probably do want to play test cricket, but it's quite unrealistic considering there's almost no country in the world currently that has even a red ball cricket at the domestic level for women. Especially even the top three don't have it. So like, without having a structure in place at the domestic level, it's quite unrealistic to expect them to play test cricket. So for that, like, first they need to start playing domestic cricket. India and Australia are now planning to have a red ball season for the women, and which is how it should be. Like, these boards can fund it. So like, every series between these boards should have at least one test. But for the others, I think it's better to play more ODI and T20I cricket. And if at all they want to play test cricket, they should first have a domestic tournament, give the players exposure and experience, and then put them into test cricket. Otherwise, we might also end up having very lopsided matches, which isn't good for the game.
That is again a fair point, and we will, you know, talk about this red ball tournament in a bit. And I also, you know, remember reading a lot of chatter about, you know, having a proper full-fledged three-match series in like your multi-format series. So do you also kind of see the validity of the same, and you know, this one-off test will kind of lose its relevance if it's just going to be one encounter, say, you know, having three test matches somewhere?
No, I again don't see any point of having three test matches. The correct way of going about it, if you want added relevance, is to have either a 5-day test, because it's highly unlikely to not get a result in 5 days unless the pitch is really bad. So the workaround then is to have a 5-day test if you're having just one test. Or the other way to go about is to have the multi-points format system, which India, Australia and England have previously used for a lot of their bilateral series. So once you do that, like, every match has relevance. So I don't think like three tests is something that's again viable, because that will also significantly lengthen the touring duration for the players. And a lot of players don't want to be away on long tours anymore, especially because now there's a lot of franchise cricket as well that they are playing, which involves a fair bit of travel and living away from home. So because this had just one test, like, Australia were still, in spite of that, like, I think away from home for almost a month, which is quite long. So like, if you have three tests, then it would either like have just three tests, which wouldn't really draw in the spectators, I feel, and it's not a great idea in my opinion. I feel like one test of 5 days, or like one test, but in the multi format point system works better.
Fair enough. And, you know, I think the whole conversation about having a 5-day test match still holds a lot of relevance because often we have seen how 4-day matches haven't really brought in that much result. So maybe an introduction of another day will definitely do a world of good. And as you said, you know, having a multi-format point system, you know, will add more relevance to a one-off test encounter like this. And also, you know, delving on this point that you brought in earlier of the introduction of this red ball tournament, I mean, reintroduction for India and Australia also wanting to have this. So do you see it as a step in, like, a welcome step in the right direction? Because, you know, more test match would kind of necessitate, right? Having tournaments like this, which kind of gets your players match ready and acclimatized to the conditions.
Yeah, like having more tournaments, especially at the domestic level, is always a good idea because that is where players develop and learn the ropes of the game. So like, even if they don't play more test cricket, like I honestly don't see them playing any more test cricket than they are currently. But what it will do is like help them develop skills which might help them in the ODI format as well. Because like, with so much of T20 cricket, a lot of people now struggle batting at the right pace or with the right technique that is required for ODI cricket, especially when the conditions are challenging. So I think it would help the players be better at ODI cricket, especially the batters and also the bowlers, because it would help them improve on their discipline and accuracy and things of that sort. And for the batters, like, it will be a good test of their stamina and how well they pace their innings and those sorts of things. So I feel like it's a good idea to have it at the domestic level, and then you can take the feedback of the players as well, and they can let you know whether it's working for them, whether they want some changes. So at the domestic level, having a red ball tournament seems like a good idea to me, especially in the zonal format, because then it would mean like only the top 90 or so cricketers of the country, or at max 100 cricketers, would be playing it. So that would mean that all your best players, plus like those who are likely to play for the A team, plus the next rung, all of them will have some exposure to red ball cricket, which ultimately will benefit them in the long run.
Definitely. And, you know, as we conclude this segment of our discussion about the one-off test series, I hope it gives our listeners also some perspective, you know, of how women's test cricket is definitely an exciting proposition. And there are so many aspects that can be improved upon. We see changes happening, but here's hoping we get to see a lot more, and India can also continue to produce results like this for us fans. And moving on to the ODI series. Now, again, the ODI series was quite disappointing because we did lose the series 0-3, and it was quite disappointing. But I think one of the major talking points definitely has to be India's ODI template, right? This is something that's not quite really working out well. I think it stemmed largely from the selection or even, you know, the kind of management of players in that playing 11. So what do you think is the mindset, and do you see some legitimacy to these claims?
Yeah, there is definite legitimacy to these claims because it's okay to lose. But with India, they keep losing after repeating the same mistakes. So that is very disappointing to see. And all these issues have now been in place for the last couple of years at least. So it's disappointing that they've not really addressed these issues or found solutions to them, because like, it's okay beating the relatively lower ranked or weaker teams, but like, if you don't win against the best teams in the world, that is how you're going to win the major tournaments, by beating the best in the world. And that is something they've not really done in a while. So I think like the problems are clear, like the lack of a finisher has been there for a long time now. India probably have players who can fill that void, but they've not played them in the right position or given them a long enough rope. The other issue is their fielding. I don't think you can win too many matches when you drop so many catches. So these issues have persisted for a while now. So I think like they need to be addressed and addressed soon, because there's a ODI World Cup coming at home next year itself.
Absolutely. And also, you know, India lost the series 0-3. Do you think the scoreline seems harsher than how the matches actually played out? Because we saw how most of the matches, you know, kind of went down to the wire, or Australia's kind of pushed to the wall to, you know, get those hard fought off wins. So what do you make of it?
No, I think the series scoreline was a very fair reflection. Like in two of the three matches, India were thoroughly outclassed by Australia. In the third match, as in the one match where they did push Australia quite hard, they should have chased that total down and closed it. But it was again a case of familiar failings and they just couldn't do it, which was again very disappointing, because when you have that many wickets in hand and such few runs to chase, it's a very comfortable equation. And when the player in the middle has so much of experience, you expect them to get the job done. So I felt like the series scoreline was a very fair reflection. And apart from that second ODI where India kind of pushed Australia really hard, they were not up to the mark in the other two ODIs at all.
That makes sense. And even when we look at each of the ODIs in isolation, let's start with the first ODI, right? India made 282, yet couldn't defend. And it was perhaps one of those off days with the ball and not being able to make the most of those conditions. So what are your thoughts on that match and things that perhaps really didn't work well for India?
Yeah, like I think this has been a problem for a while now for India, because since the start of 2022, they've like lost seven ODIs where they've scored 270 plus runs. No other team in the world has like lost that many ODIs in that period after scoring such amount of runs. So on that pitch against Australia, it was probably a total that was around 20 or so short of par. But the fact that Australia chased it down so comfortably with like six wickets in hand and almost four overs to spare, like they weren't even pushed in that chase at any point of time. They just always looked very comfortable. So that is a worrying sign for India, and probably like points at a couple of issues. Like one obviously is the fielding, which we spoke about, but the other issue is the lack of wicket taking options, because you won't be winning too many matches if you take four wickets in 47 overs. So I felt, and in this match, India's ground fielding was poor, but they didn't really drop too many catches as such. So it mostly had to do with the bowling. And it was their fifth bowler, basically, which caused them this match, because all four of Sneh Rana, Deepti Sharma, Renuka Singh Thakur and Pooja Vastrakar had a fairly good game. But like Australia took full toll of India's fifth bowler by realizing that Saika Ishak was on debut and Amanjot Kaur still a very inexperienced player at the international level. So they targeted India's fifth bowler, and some of the captaincy from Harmanpreet Kaur was also extremely baffling. I felt like, I don't know why she was bowling in the final 10 overs when India had overs to spare from both Sneh Rana and Deepti Sharma. So I thought the captaincy also was poor at certain points. But overall, I think like just not enough wicket-taking bowlers was probably an issue for them.
Definitely. And also, you know, the bowling was a massive letdown. I think the batting still had something to reflect on, right? Because Jemmy, the ODI batter, has been an absolute revelation. So what are your thoughts on her, you know, trying to revamp her game and be that ideal middle order bat for India?
Yeah, it's very impressive. Actually, like she's a player who's actually worked very hard on the shortcomings in her game, and you can clearly see how much she has improved in the last couple of years, from the time she was dropped for the ODI World Cup in 2022 to now. And you have to give her a lot of credit also, because like she's batting at number 5 now for India, which is a position where she almost never bats at in domestic cricket. So it's not easy at all to bat in an unfamiliar position and do so well, that too against a team like Australia, which has a high quality bowling lineup. And she's been doing it consistently for a while now. She was India's best batter in their last ODI series as well versus Bangladesh. And here as well, like you said, in the first ODI, she was exceptional. And the other player who was very good was Pooja Vastrakar, because again, when she walked into bat, India were 182 for 7. So they could have easily been restricted to 240 or so, but like the way she batted, hitting 62 of just 46 balls, she's done it before as well against Australia. So I'm sure it must have felt like deja vu for them. But her effort was as impressive as Jemima's. So it was a little disappointing to not see her get bumped up from number 9 to say number 6 or something in the remaining two ODIs, especially when she had done so well in the first ODI. I think Pooja was again one big positive for India from that first ODI, apart from Jemmy, who's been supremely consistent.
Oh, definitely, because that was the time, you know, we were facing some problems with losing wickets early on. And I think knocks like this kind of remind us their relevance in this team and why they're such important clutch players. And when we look at the second ODI as well, now restricting Australia to 258 was a commendable effort considering the kind of bowling we had had in that first one. But again, we thought India would cruise to a win, yet, you know, we fell short. So how would you dissect that match? And again, you know, do you think it was us not making the most of those clutch situations?
Yeah, the bowling effort was exceptional in this match because that was not really a pitch where 258 should have been enough. And I think it was Deepti Sharma who did the bulk of the damage. Like, it was a superb effort from her, becoming the first Indian ever to take 5 wickets in an ODI against Australia. And she got the big wickets again. She got a lot of the key wickets. She got Elise Perry. She got Beth Mooney. She got Talia Magra. So a lot of their better batters she dismissed. And the other bowler who really impressed was Shreyanka Patil on debut, getting PB Litchfield, who was eventually the player of the series. So I think like Shreyanka's debut was a big positive for India, because I can't think of too many Indian debutants who've looked so good and so at ease on the international stage in their first ODI, especially against the best team in the world. So I thought those two were like the big positives from India's bowling effort. And as far as the batting is concerned, I felt like, especially considering they'd gotten in Harleen Deol as a concussion substitute for Sneh Rana, their whole batting order was absolutely bizarre. Like, I really didn't understand the point of sending in Deepti Sharma at number 6, because when she walked in, India needed around a run a ball or just slightly lesser than that. And we've seen in the past as well on many occasions that she's somebody who's not probably best suited to these kind of situations. And considering India had a specialist batter in Harleen Deol as well as Pooja Vastrakar, who'd done so well in the last match, it made no sense to send her out at that point of time. So I felt like, and after that, it was a familiar tale for India, because they were in the match till Richa Ghosh got out. At that stage also, they needed like, I think, 40 odd runs in 6 overs with 5 wickets left. I think you'd back most teams to get that, especially like a team that wants to be the best team in the world. So it was very disappointing to again see this where their finisher couldn't do the job and their lower order also couldn't step up to the plate, because this was a match that they should have won because the bowlers had done exceptionally well. The fielding was a big letdown because India dropped 7 catches in this match, which must be some sort of a record, because I personally don't remember watching any India ODI where they've dropped so many catches. But yeah, in spite of that, bowling Australia out for 258 was an exceptional effort. Not bowling them out, but yeah, restricting them to 258. Sorry.
Certainly. I mean, we did have a lot of areas that did not really work well, and we ended up, you know, conceding a massive lead to Australia in that 3-match series of 2-0. And coming into this third ODI as well, there is a little hope, right, that India would play for pride. But Australia kind of, you know, rode on that momentum and they got to a 190-run win. So, you know, another disappointing showing for India and a massive rethink into some of the strategies.
Yeah, the third ODI was probably the only match where they were completely outplayed right through the 7 matches against Australia. Like, so that was probably their most disappointing performance, because apart from Shreyanka Patil again with the ball and Deepti Sharma, who'd been like excellent right through the series, none of their other bowlers like stuck to plans or bowled the right kind of length or lines on that pitch. But again, like that pitch didn't really have much in it for the bowlers. So, but yeah, still because of India's dropped catches and poor fielding, Australia probably scored 20 more than they should have. But India's batting effort again was very listless. Like the only way to describe it is listless. And I think like the senior players not stepping up was a big disappointment. Smriti Mandhana played well and got starts, but she didn't really play that one big knock which she's known for. Like what India needed from her was a big 100 or a 80, 90 kind of innings, which they never got right through this ODI series. But at least she scored at a good pace and took advantage of the power play. But the biggest disappointment for India was Harmanpreet Kaur, because I don't think her batting was up to the mark, which is okay, it can happen. But her captaincy left a lot of questions to be answered. And again, in this match, India sent out Deepti Sharma at number 6, which was strange considering what had transpired in the last match. So, like, I didn't really understand the logic of it. Maybe they still want to back her as the finisher, but I personally don't think that's going to work out for them, especially on good pitches like this.
Certainly. And as we, you know, get to this Deepti point a little later on. Now, I think another interesting move that India pulled off in this series was Richa coming in at 3, right? So many were expecting that Jemmy would be that number 3, but then the team management kind of surprised us with, you know, this upward transition of Richa at number 3. So were you convinced with this move and, you know, dislodging Richa from her usual finisher position to a more, you know, like solid middle order, like at number 3 is the way to go?
For me personally, I don't think that is the way to go, because I feel like Richa is a very talented player and she's like good enough to succeed anywhere in the batting order from number 1 to number 7. So I don't have any doubts that she can make for a very good number 3 player. But the issue then is like, what Richa is capable of doing at number 5 or 6, I don't think anybody else in Indian cricket currently is capable of that. So for that reason, I'd like you said, I'd like to see somebody like Jemima probably bat at number 3 and Richa to bat at 5 or 6. Because what she does in those positions, nobody else can do that in Indian cricket. And we've seen that on the big stage as well. She was a big reason of why India made the T20 World Cup semis, where she like did a really good job as finisher and finished a lot of, if not finished, but also took, at least took India to the brink of victory. And we've seen that in, at the domestic level as well from her. Like she's played the role of finisher to perfection for Bengal. So I feel like she's one player who's capable of batting anywhere, but because nobody else can do what she can do at number 5 or 6, I'd like India to like bat Richa at 5 or 6. Like I see the logic of batting her at 3, but unfortunately India don't really have anybody else who can do what she does lower down. So I don't think Richa at 3 is a good idea, because there are many batters in India who can do a good job at number 3.
Agreed. And I mean, I believe in the same school of thought that, you know, having her come in that early at 3 may not augur well for India, considering she brings in that attacking brand of cricket, which is much more suited at that number 5 or 6 position. And another bizarre decision, I'm going to call it bizarre, because Deepti Sharma coming in at 6 is probably like not the most ideal way to go, because we've seen how she takes a lot of time to settle in. The strike rate is definitely not in her favor. So do you think, you know, India should probably experiment with having someone else coming in at number 6 and ODI is going ahead? And by any means, were you convinced with the move?
No, not at all. Because like earlier in this show, you once touched upon player management. When it comes to Deepti Sharma, it's a classic case of player mismanagement. Like to her credit, she like goes out wherever the team asks her to, in spite of being a senior player now. But this is as classic a case as possible of mismanagement, because this is a player who's been playing international cricket for almost 10 years now. And by now you have enough evidence to know that she's not a player who should be batting at 6 when you need a runner ball in a chase. So I really don't think she is the right person to be batting at number 6. At the domestic level, she opens the batting for Bengal, and that is probably her best position. But India have like much better options there, so there's no chance that she can open the batting for India. So then, like looking at her bowling, she's like good enough to make the team on her bowling alone. So I think India should pick her as a bowler and somebody who's very good in the field. But I don't think like India should consider her as somebody who can bat in the top six anymore, especially where like you need to score quickly. Sometimes if you've lost two or three wickets very early, you can send her up because she can do a good job of consolidating the innings and setting a platform. But like in the third ODI, India lost four wickets in the first 15 overs. So maybe that's why she came at six. But like I was listening to Amol Mazumdar's post-tour presser, where he said that they wanted to back the players that they've picked in certain roles. So going by that, it doesn't look like, at least for the next series, India would be changing Richa or Deepthi's batting positions. But based on what we've seen over the years and how India performs and what their players' capabilities are, I think like Richa should definitely bat at number five or six, and Deepthi probably is not the player you want to be batting at number six.
Definitely, because if India is looking to get on those big scores on the board, I don't think Deepthi, the batter, brings in that much value as the bowling aspect of hers does. So yeah, food for thought, and here's hoping the management can have a deep rethink into this whole strategy. And now, you know, guiding our conversation on to the T20i series. Now, again, I think somewhere, you know, the T20i series saw how India's fortune changed. We had a win to start off the proceedings with. So what were your thoughts on that first T20i, and was it like good things coming our way?
Yeah, I think lots of positives from that first T20i, and none bigger than Tita Sadhu, because this was the first time she was playing against Australia, the first time she was playing in this series, and what an entry to make. Like, this is what India was lacking in the ODI series, their fast bowler striking in the power play, providing them with those key early wickets. And she managed to do that, because after that, like once an opposition's three or four down, like bowlers like Deepthi Sharma or Shreyanka Patil also can be a lot more effective. To their credit, they still did exceptionally well in the ODI series, but here like they came in with the opposition in a lot of trouble, and they like managed to exploit that even more, which is why India managed to bowl out Australia for just 141 in spite of them batting till number nine, where they have Georgia Wareham, who's like good enough to bat in the top six. So I think it was an exceptional bowling effort. And again, it was those two off spinners who provided great support to Tita Sadhu. So I felt like this was probably India's best bowling performance across the ODIs and T20Is. And it gave India a lot of hope, because you were talking about that 75 chase, but this was the chase where I was a little nervous, because in the past we've seen India bungle up quite a few chases against Australia. The scores maybe were more in the 160-ish range rather than 145. But just the way Shefali Varma especially batted, and most importantly managed to stay not out and finish the job that she had started, was extremely impressive, because she was dropped during the ODI series. Her form in the last 18 months or so hasn't really been the way she would have liked, at least at the international level, because at the domestic and WPL level, she is a colossus. So I think like this was a great, great batting display from Shefali, like one of her best innings ever, I'd say, in international cricket. And that like helps Smriti also a fair bit, because she was... Yeah, I think like the other big positive for India was Shefali Varma, and how well she batted, like not just by providing India a great start, but also by staying not out and finishing the job. Like in the power play, I thought she like took the bowlers on, scored really quickly, which took a lot of pressure off Smriti, who was like going at under a runner ball. And she could afford to do that because Shefali was batting as well as she was and scoring as quickly as she was. So it never let like the dot ball pressure get to India. And I feel like it was one of her best innings ever at the international level. And very pleasing to see because she was dropped in the ODI series. So it was an important innings for her as well, because in the last 18 months or so, the performances from her haven't been the way she would like them to be at the international level. So I felt like Shefali Varma was another big positive for India from the first T20.
Absolutely agreed. And, you know, even when you look at Australia, they are definitely not a side that's going to let you take the advantage away. Now, in the second T20, yet again, we saw how Australia came back strong and they won that encounter. So what did you make of it? And did it kind of expose any frailties that India could be perhaps facing in this format?
Yeah, like I thought, like against Australia, this was a great opportunity for them to win the series, especially considering they'd won the first T20I and in the previous year also, like in 2022, when Australia had come to India, they'd beaten them in one T20I via the super over. So I thought like this was a great chance for India to probably win a bilateral T20I series against them. But the batters didn't really turn up in the second match. And again, like the lack of runs from the senior players really cost India, because again, Harmanpreet Kaur fell for a very cheap score. Smriti got out after getting in and chewing up a lot of balls. And Jemima was looking really good, but then she just got out. But she was probably the only batter in the Indian top four who like scored at a good clip in this match. So I think like India just ended up facing way too many dot balls, and then Richa Ghosh tried to like get some big hits away and somehow got them to 130, but that was never really going to be enough against this Australian output. I thought like the bowlers did an exceptional job though to take the match all the way to the 19th over, because what we've seen from Australia in the past is they don't usually take more than, say, 14 to 16 overs to chase down totals of this kind. So I thought the bowlers did fantastically well to take the match all the way to the 19th over. Like, almost every bowler that India used bowled pretty well. And yeah, like, they didn't take too many wickets, but on that pitch, like, 130 was never really going to be enough. And again, like the problem for India was once they lose three or four wickets, apart from Richa Ghosh, they don't really have anybody who's consistent and can salvage those kind of situations for them. Because in the first T20I, Australia also were 33 for 4. But then in spite of that, PB Litchfield and Elise Perry kept going hard and put on almost an 80-run partnership at a very good rate. So I don't think India has that kind of players apart from Richa Ghosh, at least didn't have in the 11 here, probably Pooja Vastrakar, but again, they chose to bat Deepti at 6. So there was no chance for Pooja to have that kind of a partnership. And by the time she walked in, like the match was already in Australia's grasp. So yeah, I think the batting order question returned for India in this match, because they had to go all the way till number 6, unlike the first T20I.
Certainly. And now, you know, with the series poised 1-1, Australia came out all guns blazing, right, to seal a series win. Once again, things quite did not work out well for India. Did you feel like there is a repetition of the same pattern of mistakes that was made in that ODI series and the two T20Is that came to bite us back here?
Yeah, it was almost an exact replica of how the entire series had been. Shefali Varma again was excellent, did the job in the power play, provided a great start, scored very quickly. But after that, Jemmy had a low score again. Like this T20I series wasn't really one of her better ones, but she's been very consistent otherwise for India in the last year or so. But Smriti again got in, got out, chewed up a lot of dot balls. Harmanpreet fell for a very low score. 4 wickets down, Deepti Sharma walks in, struggles to rotate strike. So somehow India still put up almost 150 thanks to Richa Ghosh, Amanjot Kaur and Pooja Vastrakar, all of whom like batted at a fairly decent clip and got a few boundaries away. But again, like sending Deepti in at number 6 made absolutely no sense, because at that stage, had they probably sent in somebody like Pooja, they could have probably ended with 20 runs more, which 20 or 25 runs more, which probably would have, I don't know if it would have been enough considering how good Australia are, but would have at least challenged them more. Because unlike the second T20I and the third T20I, Australia were always in the control and the chase. To India's credit, their bowlers again didn't bowl badly at all. I felt they bowled disciplined lines. Their plans were good. It's just that Australia had a better side and their batters showed their quality. But I think India's big problem in this T20I series was their batting and their three most senior players not really doing anything of note with the bat.
Definitely. And I think here also, you know, let's reflect on Harmanpreet Kaur's captaincy, because that really came under the scanners through the, you know, limited overs format series, because she's just not quite up to the mark. A lot of calls were baffling and something certainly did not, you know, seem to work well with her batting as well. So what do you make of, you know, Harmanpreet Kaur, the captain, and even the batter not being able to get runs?
Yeah, the problem now is she's not even scoring runs with the bat. Sometimes, like, even if your captaincy is not great, but you're contributing a lot to the team with the bat and winning matches for the team with the bat, then some of the captaincy talk goes out of the window. But if you're not, like, turning up with the bat as well, and if your captaincy is not great, then you are, like, in a very precarious place. Thankfully for her, she has the confidence of Amol Muzumdar. I would say, like, as a batter, she has enough runs in the bank and enough credit to still be a part of the Indian team, because I think she's still among India's best six batters in both ODIs and T20Is. As far as captaincy is concerned, it probably now might be too late for India to change their captain for the T20I World Cup, considering there's barely any time or matches left before the tournament. But it's important for her to acknowledge her errors and work on them, because I don't see it happening in the last couple of series that India has played. Like, it's the same mistakes that are getting repeated. So then that raises questions about not just the captain, but the team management in general, which would involve the captain, vice captain, as well as the coaching staff. Considering this was Amol Mazumdar's first series in charge, maybe he was also learning, because he also might have not watched or known a lot of these players before. So maybe he was just backing the captain and vice captain for the calls that they were making. But that could just be conjecture, because he was also clearly making a lot of decisions. So, but he seems like the kind of person who wants to learn from his mistakes and, like, make the side better. So I hope he realizes where the shortcomings are and works on them, because that is what he did as Mumbai captain and coach, in both of which roles he had a fair bit of success. So I hope he does with the same with the Indian team. As far as Harmanpreet Kaur is concerned, I think she has a lot to work on tactically as well as just being a leader, because some of her interviews and all during the series also didn't make for great listening. So I think there's a lot for her to work on, but most importantly, she needs to, like, start getting runs on the board, because if she has one more series like this, I don't think it would then be justified to even have her in the squad. So I think time's running out for her. This might probably be her last chance to win the T20 World Cup, considering she'll be 37 by the time the next T20 World Cup comes around. So it's time she pulls up her socks, both tactically as well as a batter. And I think the upcoming WPL will be key, because if she doesn't get runs even over there and has a poor season, India will be forced to look at other options, at least as captain, if not as a batter. So I feel like the upcoming WPL will be key for her, because the first season she was great as a batter, very good as captain. Obviously, she had some great coaches with her in the form of Charlotte Edwards, Jhulan Goswami, Lydia Greenway, Devika Palshikar. So that must have helped. But yeah, like, I feel like the upcoming WPL might have a lot of significance for somebody like Harmanpreet Kaur to show that she still got it, both as batter and captain.
Definitely, because she is one among our more celebrated cricketers in the country, and the kind of contributions she has done will definitely go down in the annals of history as well. And getting unceremoniously dropped or sacked is not going to be the perfect, icing on that cake or the ending to her career. So here's hoping, she can really figure out her batting and perhaps come back stronger. And, just taking the conversation on to another interesting tournament that's happening on the side, we have the Senior Women's One Day Trophy happening, right? So we've again seen a lot of impressive performances from this tournament. And do you believe there are any players who can slot themselves immediately into the team as like-for-like replacements?
Looking at the Australia series, since this is the one day format, I feel like there were a few areas that India needed to address. Like they maybe need a backup opener or a second opener, depending on Shefali Verma's form. I still think Smriti and Shefali can get the job done, but the India do need a backup opener. They also need a finisher, and there are obviously openings for a fast bowler or fast bowling all-rounder and a leg spinner as well as a left-arm spinner. So I think I never got why they dropped Rajeshwari Gaikwad from the ODI team. So I think this One Day Trophy, again, she's had a great tournament for Railways. So I think she's somebody who should straight away come back into the team. As far as leg spin is concerned, I feel like somebody like Asha Joy is a good option. She had a great WPL, good senior women's T20 trophy, and exceptional senior women's one day trophy. And the other leg spinner who's really good is Delhi's Priya Mishra, just 19. So she still might be too raw for the international stage. I'd like to see how she goes in the WPL. But somebody like Asha, I think, can be a part of the Indian team. The only thing that might count against her is her age, but I don't think that should be a factor, because going by that logic, somebody like Harmanpreet Kaur is also 35. So I think you should apply the same yardstick to every player, and the performances are there. Ekta Bisht again has had a great season, but she's already 37. So I don't know if she will be around in 18 months' time when the next ODI World Cup is. But yeah, Rajeshwari Gaikwad is a lot younger, so she should be there. And as far as the finisher's role is concerned, Dayalan Hemlata, as always, has had a great tournament, best player of spin in the country, without a doubt. Can get the big hits away too. Very good on Indian pitches. The next World Cup is in India, so she definitely should be in the Indian squad. The other player who's done well in the finisher's role in this senior women's one day trophy is Kiran Navgire. So I'd like to see how she goes in the WPL, because that's a higher level of competition, better bowling attacks. And I hope she bats it six this time for UP Warriors, so India can then see what she can offer in that role. Because I think UP have enough options that can bat in the top three. So those two for the finisher's role. And lastly, for the backup opener, I'd like to look at somebody like Shweta Sehrawat, because she's had a absolutely blockbuster season, most runs, highest ever score in List A cricket by an Indian woman. So if she does well in the knockouts and in the WPL, she probably should be somebody who should come into the Indian ODI squad as well.
Absolutely agree with you on these players, who definitely have made a name for themselves. And now seeing them in the Women's Premier League will be quite exciting, because squaring off against tougher players will bring out the best in them. Also, presenting them as options for the senior women's team. And even looking at India's, FTP, we next play the Asia Cup in July. So are there any updates on the venue? And of course, the squad will be announced just with a week to go. But with a World Cup in the reckoning, and we don't have a lot of matches scheduled, of course, this is a situation that's far from ideal. So we'll have to hinge a lot of our selection and understanding of these players on the basis of the Women's Premier League, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially considering there are just, we discussed the ODI squad in depth, but there are quite a few places up for grabs in the T20I team as well, at least in the squad, at least maybe around three or four, at least, I would say, if not five. So I think, like you said rightly, the WPL will be a key tournament because that is the only T20 tournament that they would be playing before the squad for the Asia Cup is selected. So yeah, like it's a good chance for a lot of the players who aren't in the squad but close to selection, or even if they are not close, they can bolt right in, because as good as Saika Ishak and Shreyanka Patil were on the domestic circuit, had it not been for the WPL, probably they would not have been fast-tracked to the Indian team as quickly as they were. So the WPL, even somebody like Kanika Ahuja, again, good numbers on the domestic circuit, but probably not somebody who would have been in the Indian team if not for the WPL. So we've clearly seen the WPL change lives of at least a few cricketers, and I'm sure this edition will also throw up a lot of exciting talent, and we will see at least two or three players from who emerge in this WPL, or like who back up their domestic performances in this WPL, go on to play for India in either the next T20 World Cup, which like you said is this year, or the ODI World Cup. As for like preparation, the Asia Cup typically will involve around 5, 6, or 7 matches depending on how far the team progresses. So that is quite a lot of matches. And if it happens in Bangladesh, which is where the T20 World Cup is also supposed to happen, nothing like it. I think 7 matches in a country where the World Cup will be a couple of months down the line is as good a preparation as anybody can ask for. Then I think there would also be the 100 in August, where typically last year, I think there were just 3 Indians who featured, but this year, hopefully there will be more. So again, they will get some game time in, but I think the BCCI can probably look at arranging another bilateral series sometime either in September beginning or in August, so that like the players get around 10 matches or so before the T20 World Cup, and that then is enough to figure out your best 11 as well as your best 15. So ideally, I'd like to see the BCCI organize one other bilateral series up, or a tri-series like they did just before the last T20 World Cup, apart from the Asia Cup. And then I think, at least in terms of preparation, there can't be anything more that the board could have done. Then it's down to the players to do what's needed on the field.
Agreed. And as you rightly pointed out, you know, we have a lot of exciting cricket that's coming up, and it does open up a lot of opportunities for them to, you know, stake their claims in the squads that are yet to be announced. So here's hoping we get to see a lot more of these players, you know, make names for themselves and eventually, you know, contribute to the team squads. And even as we reach the end of our discussion, do you have any last and final thoughts for our listeners?
Yeah, it'll just be the typical thoughts as always. I'd say like just subscribe to the podcast, listen to it, because I personally love listening to it. Like even the accounts on social media, they are full of information. Like a lot of times I get my day's wrap of cricket from all over the world, like men's cricket, franchise cricket, everything through this account, never on the back foot. So it's always great to be on the podcast, and I hope the listeners subscribe to it and listen to all the other episodes as well, because there are some truly great people who come on the podcast, be it cricketers, journalists, or just fans who really like are passionate about cricket in general.
Thank you so much, Mohit, for those kind words. And yeah, it's always about creating, you know, a lot of these conversations around the beautiful sport of cricket. So yeah, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing these remarkable insights. It was really fun, you know, shooting side A and side B with you. I was hoping we can have you back again. And until next time, stay safe and take care. Thank you so much, Mohit. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, listeners, for tuning into this episode, Side A and Side B, and for your unstinted support. Please follow and press the bell icon on Spotify and subscribe to the podcast on Google Podcasts for the latest episode updates, and stay tuned. Do check out @NeverInTheBackFoot on Instagram and Threads, and @NeverInTheBack1 on Twitter, now called X, for the latest facts, updates, fresh content, and a lot more that's coming up this cricket season. The podcast is also available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Spotify, Overcast, Spotify for Podcasters, and many other platforms. So please do spread the word. Never on the Back Foot is now also on YouTube. So don't forget to subscribe to the channel and stay tuned for a lot of insightful conversations. Until next time, stay safe and take care, listeners. Bye for now.